Hello, everybody. This is George Ann Hughes, and this is The Bike Show. And we are blessed to have with us David Seeloff. David is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. You can go to the website www.askelm, A-S-K-E-L-M. And we are working on a series, The Star of Bethlehem, The Star That Astonished the World. And tonight we are going to discuss or get into an appendix in that book, and it is appendix number 4. And it is about sabbatical years and chronology. And this is going to be pretty interesting. Hi, David.
Hi, George Ann. We've done all 13 chapters and the introduction on previous shows. And we decided to do this Appendix 4. A, it's long enough and justified that we do it. And B, it's interesting for other reasons than just specifically relating to the Star of Bethlehem.
Right.
The first three appendices are rather short or very involved, and except for technical people interested in technical chronological material that don't relate directly to the birth of Christ, they might be of some interest to people, and they're available on the website, on the ASK website. But Appendix 4 has general applicability, and it's titled The Sabbatical Years and Chronology. And, of course, I'm reading the words of Dr. Ernest Martin from his book, The Star of Bethlehem, the Star That Astonished the World. The correct dating of Jesus' birth is primarily a chronological matter. What one must do is to use all avenues of investigation that contain chronological evidences or even hints that can reasonably establish a proper chronological background to that historical event. The prime evidence comes from those individuals who were eyewitnesses or record information from eyewitnesses, and this is why the information in the Bible itself is so important in understanding the chronology associated with the nativity of Jesus. And the information in the Bible does not disappoint us. Indeed, there is a further method found in the Bible and in history for determining the time of the birth of Jesus. And this is the Old Testament legislation that demanded that the Jews let their lands, the agricultural lands in the region of Palestine, lie fallow every seventh year. And this is in Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 7. Every seventh year, all commercial farming or agricultural activity, including, olive groves and trees that bear fruit, almond trees and that sort of thing, all agricultural activity came to a halt in the seventh year. These years, every seventh year, were known as sabbatical years. And these sabbatical years are important, especially in determining the length of King Herod's reign. Josephus tells us clearly that the battle in which King Herod captured Jerusalem took place during a sabbatical year. So that gives us a benchmark, from one seven-year period to another, and that actually King Herod captured the city of Jerusalem on the Day of Atonement. We now have abundant evidence that the occurrence of that particular sabbatical year, when this well-known conquest of Jerusalem occurred, was in 36 B.C. The Jewish king Antigonus was killed a few months later. Josephus tells us that Herod reigned for 34 years after the death of Antigonus. This means that Herod reigned unto, up to, 2 to 1 B.C. This is precisely what Dr. Martin says, as he is showing in this book. And he says, what I will do in this appendix is to reveal that the New Testament itself supports the fact that the sabbatical cycle of years makes the summer of 36 B.C. to have been a sabbatical year. This will show Herod's death to be in 1 B.C. Now, regarding the Jews and sabbatical years, the Jews, before and during the time of Jesus, followed the Mosaic law for agricultural inactivity during every seventh year in the land of Palestine. Because of this practice, it affords us some excellent chronological clues regarding the time that certain historical events occurred in Palestine. This is because the records show that these events happened in association with sabbatical years. And thankfully, it is possible from the Bible and history to accurately determine those years in which the Jews refrained from agricultural activity. Once the cycle of those 7 years is understood, then those sabbatical years can be used as chronological benchmarks in determining important events in Jewish history during the time of Jesus. Now, regarding the cycle of sabbatical years, this can now be known. New evidence has become available, which gives powerful proof for properly dating the years of Jesus' ministry, and even the year of his crucifixion is able to be determined. This new information from the New Testament itself provides a major key which makes other chronological indications of the New Testament more understandable. It also shows the sabbatical year in which Herod captured Jerusalem was indeed 36 B.C. The Gospel of John records some prime chronological references for reckoning the years of Jesus' ministry that the other three Gospels do not report. For example, John mentions three Passovers which occurred during the ministry of Jesus. This is in John 2, verse 13, John 6, verse 4, and John 13, verse 1. Other Jewish festivals were acknowledged as well. There was the, quote, unknown feast, end quote, between the first two Passovers. This is in John 5, verse 1. And after the second Passover, John mentions the Feasts of Tabernacles and Dedication. The Feast of Tabernacles is mentioned in John 7, verse 1, and the Feast of Dedication in John 10, verse 22. These feasts provide some chronological indications for establishing the proper sequence of years associated with Jesus' ministry. The new evidence that I am presenting in this book centers on a statement given by Jesus that John positions between his first two Passovers. And this is comparing John 2:13 and John 6:4. Between his first two Passovers and before his unknown feast of John 5, verse 1. This reference is an important piece of historical information that up to now has been completely overlooked and misunderstood. When the new research is recognized, we will have one of the most significant chronological keys for ironing out the historical difficulties associated with the chronology of Jesus' life. Now, it is first essential to understand the historical environment in which this new chronological evidence occurs. Once this is understood, the year in which Jesus began his ministry can be determined, which in turn will reveal the exact year using a different set of evidence than we've covered previously in the book, which in turn will also reveal the exact year in which Jesus was born according to New Testament historical indications. This new biblical evidence is important. At the end of the third chapter of John's Gospel, we are told that Jesus left Jerusalem after the first Passover mentioned by John, and he started on his journey toward Galilee. And this is indicated in John chapter 4, verse 3. his route, Jesus' route, necessitated traveling through Samaria. Upon his arrival at Jacob's well, being weary from his journey, Jesus talked to a Samaritan woman while his disciples went into the village to fetch food. No other people were around when the discussion mentioned by John took place. However, this is in John chapter 4, verses 6 to 26. However, upon the conclusion of the dialogue, the disciples returned with food. Jesus then gave them some spiritual teaching about what true food actually represented. It is this particular teaching, when the woman had left and no other Samaritans were around, that solves a major chronological problem regarding the time and length of Jesus' ministry. Jesus said, quote, "Say you not, there are yet 4 months, and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white and ready for harvest." This is in John chapter 4, verse 35. The real meaning of Jesus' words has not been understood, yet his intention is so easy to comprehend if the legal requirements governing Palestinian agriculture in the first century are taken into account. In a moment, I'll show what Jesus had in mind when he made this statement. But first, let's review the normal interpretations given by scholars to try to explain what Jesus meant. First, some opinions of theologians. There are basically two explanations normally offered by theologians. First, since Jesus was speaking within the context of sowing and reaping, it's recognized, and correctly, that Jesus was calling attention to the barley and the wheat harvest, which farmers reaped between Passover and Pentecost, from late March to early June. Scholars have seen significance in the phrase, quote, 4 months unto the harvest, end quote. If Jesus meant that there were yet 4 months until the time of the Palestinian grain harvest, then it is supposed that he must have uttered his statement about late December or early January. This would allow the phrase 4 months to harvest to make reasonable sense. If this is the case, scholars have surmised, it would mean that Jesus gave this illustration to the disciples some 8 or 9 months after John's first Passover, and about 4 months before the beginning of the regular grain harvest, which started about late March. So, most conservative theologians have felt that this is a chronological statement which can be placed within the months of December or January near the end of Jesus' first year of the ministry, of his ministry. The second explanation suggests that Jesus was simply stating a well-known proverb about some four-month interval of time from sowing to harvest, and that no chronological significance is to be interpreted from this so-called proverbial reference. Now, there are flaws in both suppositions. For one, Jesus' statement could hardly have been made some 8 or 9 months after the first Passover, because in verse 45, given shortly after he returned to Galilee, his Galilean acquaintances recalled the signs that he recently accomplished at John's first Passover. These were Galileans who had gone to the feast. It says, quote, "For they had gone on, for they also went unto the feast," end quote. Anyone should recognize that this refers to the first Passover mentioned by John, which happened about 6 or 7 weeks before. If this was not the case, then the words of John's gospel are incomprehensible. To say that the Galileans were referring to an unmentioned Feast of Pentecost or an unnamed Feast of Tabernacles or even the Feasts of Dedication or Purim is stretching the matter beyond reasonable belief. Truly, the Galileans must have been talking about the previous Feast of Passover, during which they had just seen Jesus perform certain miracles, and that Passover had occurred no more than 40 or 50 days before. This means that Jesus' statement made at Jacob's well about a week before he met the Galileans in Nazareth was not uttered in the month of January, or December or January, and not 8 or 9 months after John's first Passover. Clearly, Jesus stated his remark in late May or early June, and the reason he did so at that time will be shown shortly. The second explanation offered by many scholars is also suspect because no such proverb has been found in Jewish literature which refers to a four-month season from sowing to harvest. The period for wheat was more like 6 months, according to the Jewish Mishnah, especially Tanit 1.7. Now, we're going to discuss the real meaning of Jesus' statement. Jesus said that his disciples would reckon four more months to the harvest, and yet his statement was proclaimed in late May or early June, right in the midst of the wheat harvest. There is no doubt that this is the case. Origen, who lived in Palestine in the 3rd century A.D., recognized that Jesus' teachings in John 4, verse 35, were stated in the middle of the actual harvest season. And this is in Origen's commentary on John. Even Jesus himself acknowledged that this time was during the regular grain harvest. Quote, "Lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white," or ripe, "all ready for harvest," end quote, in John 4:35. This reference by Jesus shows that the grain was already available in the fields for harvest. After all, it was late May or early June. But for some reason, he put it in the mouths of the disciples that they would not expect anyone to harvest the grain for another 4 months. Why on earth did Jesus say that there were yet four more months before harvest when the harvest season was at its height? Well, the answer is simple. If one remembers the agricultural legislation that Moses imposed upon the Jews and Samaritans living in the Holy Land, there were agricultural rules that both groups observed in the first century, Samaritans as well as the Jews. The truth is, Jesus made his statement in the midst of what the Jews and Samaritans both called a sabbatical year. Such a year was one in which no sowing or reaping was permitted from the new year of one autumn to the new year of the next. When this is realized and understood, well, all chronological difficulties associated with John 4, verse 35, thoroughly disappear, though they appear to be outright contradictions on the surface. Notice how plain the whole matter becomes. Jesus gave his teaching at the end of the second Hebrew month, or at the start of the third, in late May or early June. When a person counts forward four more months, the month of Tishri, the Jewish month of Tishri, is reached. This is the month in which all sabbatical years ended, and people could legally begin to harvest once again. Jesus was saying what the apostles and the general population were well aware of. That year was a sabbatical year. No one could commence any harvesting, even though it was in the midst of the harvest season, the first harvest for grain. But no one could commence any harvesting until the sabbatical year was over. This is the reason Jesus said it was still 4 months to the period of harvest. There is more evidence to support this interpretation. Jesus elaborated on his teaching about the harvest by saying in John chapter 4, verses 37 and 38, quote, "And herein is this saying true, quote, one sows and another reaps, end quote. I send you to reap that which you bestowed no labor," unquote. Even Jesus adopted the theme of a sabbatical year by telling his disciples that the harvest he asked them to engage in was one in which they had done no labor. How true this illustration would have been, even for the physical harvest of a sabbatical year, during sabbatical years, no one could labor on the land at all. There was to be no harvest, no sowing, no plowing, no pruning, no harvesting was permitted. So even Jesus' statement that the disciples had bestowed no labor on the harvest that he was talking about is indicative of the fact that that year was sabbatical. Jesus uses terms only applicable to sabbatical years. Another point needs to be made. Since Jesus gave his illustrations in John chapter 4, verses 35 to 38, at the time the fields were already white for harvest, he strongly implies that no one was in the fields doing any reaping. If all the fields were then ripe for harvest, and that is what Jesus said, this is a powerful suggestion that none of the fields, no matter how many there were, was then being harvested by the people. And, of course, this would have been the case in a sabbatical year. All the fields were not then being harvested. In case some might doubt that fields in sabbatical years would produce very much grain, since they had not sowed in the previous autumn and winter, all one has to do is to recall what that Leviticus 25 verse 5 indicates, that there would always be a crop during the fallow sabbatical years from the grains that fell on the ground in the sixth year of harvest. Grain was on the stalks, but unharvested. Now, are we talking about the day of Pentecost? There is yet another piece of evidence that the event which occurred at Jacob's well happened in a sabbatical year. This is Luke's parallel account of what transpired in Galilee soon after Jesus had returned to his hometown of Nazareth from the Passover at Jerusalem. Luke tells us in the Greek that on, quote, the day of the Sabbaths, end quote, or another way of expressing it is on the day of the weeks, which is another possible way of saying Pentecost to agree with the terminology of Exodus 34:22, Deuteronomy 16:10, and 2 Chronicles 8:13. Jesus was handed a scroll when he was in the synagogue, handed the scroll of Isaiah, and he read Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2. And Luke recorded the occasion. And this is a translation from the Greek, not from the King James Version. Quote, and he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and he entered, as his custom was, into the synagogue on the day of Sabbaths, or the day of weeks, in other words, Pentecost, and he stood up to read. And he was handed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and he opened the scroll and found the place where it is written, quote, the Lord's Spirit is upon me, because he has anointed me. He anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor, has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and sight to the blind, to set free the bruised, to proclaim the Lord's acceptable year, end quote. And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And in the eyes of all the synagogue, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed upon him. And he began to say unto them, today has this scripture been fulfilled in your ears, end quote. It should be noted that the synagogue attendant handed Jesus the scroll of Isaiah. This hints that the synagogue liturgy required Isaiah to be read on that day. If so, this would indicate that Jesus read the regular triennial cycle selection from the prophets that accompanied the sequential readings from the five books of Moses. It is interesting that the section that Jesus quoted was that which paralleled the readings from the Law of Moses for Pentecost on the second year of the triennial cycle. And this is, in the article called Triennial Cycle in the Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1906 edition by Funk and Wagnalls, there is a chart on that article, Triennial Cycle, which you know, clearly shows what this cycle entailed and what was read when. This is just another indication that this event in the synagogue in Nazareth occurred on Pentecost. Though I am in no way insisting that the phrase, the day of the weeks, on which Jesus read Isaiah 61:1-2, was Pentecost, yet it may have been, and I believe it was, it is still clear that the event happened in the late springtime, just after Jesus had returned from Jerusalem from John's first Passover. It was certainly the same year that Jesus gave his teaching about the sabbatical year in John 4:35. With this in mind, we have a further reference to that year, that that year was sabbatical. Note that Jesus called that year, quote, the acceptable year of the Lord, end quote. This is a phrase indicating the time of release. Even the use of this phrase shows that this year was a sabbatical year. Now, what we're going to show now, Dr. Martin's going to show that the first year of Jesus' ministry was sabbatical. These terms that Jesus was using in his discourse at the synagogue in Nazareth were those associated with sabbatical years and also with the Jubilee, which was a type of sabbatical years. But Jubilee years were not being celebrated by the Jews in the first century. They were observed and noted, but they were not observed. Yet the ordinary 7-year sabbatical cycle was very much in evidence among the Jews and Samaritans. So let's look at the factors within Jesus' quote from Isaiah, which suggested this. Jesus said that first he was anointed to preach good tidings to the poor. This is a reflection on the sabbatical regulations that the poor and the stranger could eat from the fields without being hindered. Second, he was to proclaim a release and to free the bruised. This recalls the sabbatical release regulations and being free from debt, as mentioned in Deuteronomy 15:1-6.
I bet that ticked off a lot of elite people.
A lot of bankers, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they worked within that system, so, I mean, they knew it had to occur.
Yeah.
But you can bet that the Pharisees made rules and regulations to get around that.
You betcha.
You know, like a pledge to, you know, repeat the obligation just as soon as the sabbatical year was over, or the new section, you know, whatever.
Yeah, what's new?
Yeah.
You know.
It's your pound of flesh, you know, while it's here.
Yes.
Well, third, Jesus was ordained to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Now, this is a reference to a sabbatical period, which years officially commenced on the Day of Atonement, according to Leviticus 25:9 and Isaiah 58:1-14. Such years are always associated with, quote, unloosing the bands of wickedness, undoing heavy burdens, letting the oppressed go free, and the breaking of every yoke, end quote, citing Isaiah 58:6. This is the type of acceptable year that Jesus was proclaiming at the synagogue in Nazareth. And the theme is clearly that of a sabbatical year. There is even more proof to show that this year was a sabbatical year. This is because Luke states that a few weeks after the disciples found themselves on a day that Luke called the second first Sabbath, and they began to eat from the grain that was in the ears of the wheat, what was this second first Sabbath? Well, the second first Sabbath, as it is in Greek, was the first weekly Sabbath of the month of Tishri, in the autumn of the year, in which the 24 priestly courses commenced their second annual cycle from a weekly to weekly Sabbath for administering in the temple. And as we noted in chapter 5 of this book, the fact is, in normal harvest years, all the grain found in barley and wheat stalks would have long been harvested. But here were the disciples on the first weekly Sabbath of the month of Tishri, and they were still finding plenty of stalks of wheat with grain in them. This again shows that the year in which this happened was a sabbatical year. That sabbatical year lasted until the Day of Atonement. And this is according to Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 22, and especially verse 9, which shows that sabbatical years began and ended on the Day of Atonement. So they were approaching the Day of Atonement when the Luke event occurred. This indication in Luke 6, verse 1, shows that there was still plenty of wheat in the fields by the first week of Tishri, as late as autumn. This would have been an extraordinary thing in normal agricultural years because the wheat harvest would have been completed by around Pentecost time, 3 months earlier. But again, that summer in Palestine, in which all this happened, was a sabbatical year. This means that we have several biblical indicators and proofs that the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry and that of Jesus' teaching started in a sabbatical year. This is why it makes excellent sense that so many people were able to follow both of them during the times of their preaching. Remember, they had huge, huge crowds because they both began their ministries during sabbatical years when people had been off from their farm labor and able to travel at leisure over the land of Palestine. Now, we can now note the sequence of sabbatical years. Though over the past few centuries, historians studying the records about sabbatical years have been able to arrive at their former sequence within a year or two, only within the last 50 years, and especially the last 30 years, has it become possible, through archaeological discoveries and other things, to determine to a near certainty what the exact sabbatical year sequence was and is even to the present day. This can now be known from 163 BC up to the present time. Two brilliant historical studies by Professor Watcholder, B.Z. Watcholder, of Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, have solved the riddle of when the sabbatical years occurred in ancient times and when they ought to be observed today. His first study is in the Hebrew Union College Annual from 1973, titled The Calendar of Sabbatical Cycles During the Second Temple and the Early Rabbinic Period. And also in the same annual for 1975 is his article, quote, The Timing of Messianic Movements and the Calendar of Sabbatical Cycles, end quote. In both these articles, and Dr. Martin will summarize the results of Professor Watcholder's excellent studies, I also will give some research materials of my own from three further references in Josephus, besides what he's already given, which substantiate the conclusions of Watcholder. I will demonstrate, Dr. Martin says, the number of precise years over the centuries which were reckoned as sabbaticals, and how we can know the exact sequence of the seventh years for the period we are discovering. Now, there's a number of factors, and we'll enumerate them. First, we are told by 1 Maccabees 6, verse 49, that Judas Maccabees' defeat at Beth Zur was in a sabbatical year, and this can be dated to the sabbatical year from the autumn of 163 to the autumn of 162 BC. In other words, during that year, that battle occurred sometime, probably during the summer, spring or summer, when most battles were fought. Second, Josephus, the Jewish historian, shows that the murder of Simon the Hasmonean happened in the sabbatical year of autumn 135 to autumn 134 BC. Josephus shows that Herod's conquest of Jerusalem, as we mentioned earlier, occurred in the last part of the sabbatical year of 37 to 36 BC. King Agrippa I recited the section of Deuteronomy in which a king was required to do as associated with the sabbatical year, which was Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 to 13, he performed it at a time which historically shows that Agrippa's sabbatical year was 41 to 42 A.D. A papyrus document written in Aramaic has recently been found in Palestine, which is dated to the second year of Nero, Emperor Nero of Rome, and it says that that particular year was a sabbatical year. Thus, 55 to 56 A.D. was sabbatical. A reference in the 2nd century A.D., a Jewish work called the Seder Olam, which was a calendar document, can be interpreted as showing that the temple at Jerusalem being destroyed in a sabbatical year. And that, of course, would have occurred in 69 to or 70 A.D. Actually, 70 A.D. on the 9th of Ab is when the temple was destroyed. Dated documents have been found concerning the Bar Kokhba revolt of the Jews against the Romans, which show that the year 132 to 133 A.D. was also a sabbatical year. The ruins of an ancient synagogue have recently been uncovered, which have a date in a mosaic for the Jewish year of 4000, and that it was the second year of a sabbatical cycle. This answers to a sabbatical year of 237 to 238 A.D. There is a reference in the Jewish Talmud in Sanhedrin 97b that the Messiah will release the world from its bondage of corruption in the year 4291 of the Jewish calendar. Since it was believed this would occur in a sabbatical year, this reference becomes important, although the prophecy, of course, did not occur, because the year after 4291 was according to our reckoning, 531 to 532 A.D., and it was indeed sabbatical. Now, the interesting thing about these sabbatical years is the fact that they are all in proper sequence. This gives the historian a great deal of confidence that this is indeed the correct solution. This would mean that all the sabbatical years in between can be known. While Professor Shurer, following Zuckerman, felt that the sabbatical year's cycle was a year earlier than presented above by Professor Watchholder, Watchholder has shown this to be untenable and mistaken. For example, in Shurer's sequence, the year 40 to 41 was sabbatical, but Josephus says that crops were able to be harvested at that year. This is in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 2, Number 200, and also in Antiquities. Even Shurer admits to the difficulty. Indeed, to use Zuckerman's and Shurer's cycle of years of 61 to 62, that year would have been sabbatical, but Josephus makes it clear that in the spring of 62 A.D., people were working on the threshing floors, which they could not have done in a sabbatical year. Now, but in the very next year, 62 to 63, Agrippa II started to rebuild Caesarea Philippi, which is what would ordinarily have happened when many farmers were looking for work in the building trade during a sabbatical year. Because everybody was out of work, they couldn't work the fields. And this is, by the way, when King Herod commenced his building projects. Professor Watchholder has indeed given us the proper sequence of sabbatical years, and my references in Josephus to Josephus given above corroborate his findings. Should also look at the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, the supplementary volume, pages 762 to 763, which also discuss this issue. Now, with all of this information, historical events in Judea can now make much better sense. Once the proper annual occurrences of the sabbatical years and their sequences are understood, all other intervening years in sequence can be tallied. When we then discover how important events occurred on them. Those years were times when the majority of the population, most of everyone was involved in agriculture, were off from their ordinary jobs. Something had to be done to keep those people busy and earning a living. There was a simple answer to this that many people have not thought of. During the 6 years of farm labor, the government took some grain and foodstuffs, just like Joseph did in Egypt. And when the sabbatical years came around, they paid the people this produce to work at construction or other types of labor. Since there was a vast reservoir of workers then available, new buildings, cities, walls, roads, irrigation projects were all undertaken. For the most part, the people did the work willingly because they believed God to be behind their efforts of keeping the sabbatical years. Now note some examples of these building activities. King Herod the Great commenced his work on the outer parts of the Great Temple of God on the sabbatical year of 23 to 22 BC. This was also the exact year that he commenced work on building the new city of Caesarea on the Mediterranean coast. And these are all Josephus references. And later, King Herod's son, Philip, started to build Caesarea Philippi in the sabbatical year of 2 to 1 BC. The city of Tiberias probably had its founding. That city was named after Emperor Tiberius. The city of Tiberias probably had its founding in 20 AD, which was also the beginning of a sabbatical year. Also, this expansive third wall around the northern parts of Jerusalem, which, if finished, Josephus said would have made Jerusalem impregnable, was no doubt started by King Agrippa the First in the sabbatical year of 41 to 42 AD. Now, and as I stated earlier, his son, Agrippa the Second, also began huge construction projects in a similar circumstance in the sabbatical year of 62 to 63 AD. Josephus said that, quote, King Agrippa enlarged Caesarea Philippi and renamed it in honor of Nero. He further built at great expense a theater for the people of Beirut and presented them with animal spectacles, spending many tens of thousands of drachmas on this project, end quote. It is because so many Jews had to take different types of jobs in sabbatical years that it was common for most of them in the first century to have two trades, two livelihoods. Recall that the Apostle Paul was a trained tent maker. Most people, and this was according to Acts 18, verse 3, most people learned these secondary trades during the sabbatical years when so many new construction projects were then underway. This is one of the main reasons that the Jewish people went along with many of the building endeavors of Herod, his expansive building projects during the sabbatical years. Now we're going to discuss the sabbatical year of Jesus' ministry. The sequence of sabbatical years is now established with almost certainty by Professor Watchholder. His information with the new interpretation, combined with the new interpretation of John 4 verse 35 that I'm giving in this book, provide a logical chronology for the years of Jesus' ministry. And we'll actually come back to the birth of Christ, how this all fits together. We can now know that Jesus gave his information about the 4 months to harvest in John 4, 35, in a sabbatical year, and that year is the one from the autumn of 27 AD to the autumn of 28 AD. There is another chronological indication in Luke's gospel that helps to substantiate this. Luke said that John the Baptist began his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. And this is in Luke 3, verse 1. Scholars have recognized several ways of reckoning this 15th year, but with our new information identifying Jesus' first year of teaching as the sabbatical year of 27 to 28 AD, we are now helped in understanding the regnal years of Tiberius as reckoned by Luke. And, you know, you can get a full discussion of the various ways that Tiberius' 15th year have been reckoned, by particularly by looking at the works of Professor Jack Finnegan in the Handbook of Biblical Chronology, either the first or second editions, or by Professor Honer's Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, either of those books. We can now consider two of the explanations which blend in perfectly well with this new chronological information. If one acknowledges the 15th year of Tiberius as being in conformity with the non-accession year based on the official Roman calendar called the Julian calendar, that 15th year would be from January 1, 28 AD, to December 31, 28 AD. This would dovetail nicely with our new proposal, yet it would mean that John the Baptist began baptizing in January 28 in the Jordan Valley. It would be acceptable since it was not excessively cold in the Jordan Depression, even during the midwinter time. However, it does press events between January and the next Passover, which occurred in late March or early April, into a hurry-up situation. Recall that Jesus himself spent 40 days in the wilderness after his baptism. And though this reckoning for the 15th year is not improbable, it is not to be preferred over the following determination, which fits in much better with all the factors, and let's notice it. Since Luke was a Gentile and writing to a nobleman named Theophilus, and both traditionally were from Antioch, Syria, it is possible that Luke was using non-accession method of reckoning regnal years in Syria from the time of Augustus, Emperor Augustus, to the time of Emperor Nerva. The 15th year of Tiberius was then from Tishri 1, 27 AD to Tishri 1, 28 AD. This would mean that Luke was calculating the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry, and consequently that of Jesus' ministry, according to the calendar with which he and Theophilus would have been familiar. And this is discussed in Honer's Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. This also has the advantage of paralleling the Jewish year, which also commenced with Tishri 1, near the time of our September. And more than that, this reckoning would also correspond precisely with the sabbatical year from the autumn of 27 AD to the autumn of 28 AD. The Jewish authorities in the Talmud state clearly that this is the very method used by Gentile rulers in relationship to the calendar of the Jews. In other words, how the Jews figured the rules of the Gentile rulers. The Gentile Romans commonly reckoned Jewish years from Tishri 1. And this is in the Avodah Zarah 10a in the Talmud. Now, the chronological importance of sabbatical years. What a significant symbolic time for John and Jesus to begin their ministries. The Jewish people were keenly aware of the prophetic significance of sabbatical years as they related to prominent people in the Old Testament periods, and also to the advent of the Messiah into the world. In literature written not long before Jesus began to preach, we have these symbolic features about the sabbatical years emphasized. The non-canonical Book of Enoch presents an apocalyptic account based on the seven sabbatical ages. And in Enoch 91, verses 12 to 17, it adds three more, a total of 10 sabbatical periods. The Book of Jubilees records that at the creation, God partitioned off time periods into sabbatical and jubilee cycles. And this is in Jubilees 1, verses 27 to 29. The births of significant people such as Adam, Noah, Abraham, and other patriarchs were timed to dovetail precisely with sabbatical eras. And both in the Dead Sea Scroll 4Q181, fragments 1 and 2 mentions this. The Dead Sea sectarians recognized future reigns of the kings of wickedness and righteousness relative to a sabbatical calendar, and believing that the last year of the cycle would be the start of the Messianic Age. This is in 1 Q. Melk 3, Section 2. These early opinions on the symbolic teachings concerning sabbatical years, though not scriptural, were no doubt prompted by the sabbatical periods recorded by the prophet Daniel. His 70 weeks prophecy was an extension of a sabbatical year's theme, and this prophecy was the prime reference point for the advent of the Messianic Age that the Jews were all expecting in the first century. Quote, Passover of the sabbatical year became the period when the Redeemer's coming was expected most, end quote. And this is according to Professor Watchholder in the Interpreter's Dictionary, Volume 1, Supplement 763. It is thus no surprise that vast crowds of people came out in the sabbatical year of 27 to 28 A.D. to be baptized of John the Baptist and Jesus' disciples. This was not only a time when a great percentage of the people would have been free of agricultural duties and able to travel at leisure following the great teachers around Palestine, but it was also the sabbatical year when many of them were expecting messianic signs to occur. It makes perfectly good sense that John the Baptist would have started his ministry in the autumn at the beginning of the sabbatical year, and that Jesus would have commenced his own teaching later. This would indicate that John the Baptist inaugurated his teaching ministry at the beginning of a sabbatical year. Soon after that, Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days and then returned to Galilee. It appears he was waiting for Passover in 28 AD to officially begin his ministry. As Professor Watchholder states, Passover of the sabbatical year became the period when the Redeemer's coming was expected the most, end quote, as we just read. It was also in the sabbatical year of 27 to 28 AD that Jesus was 30 years of age. At the Passover of 28 AD, when he officially began his ministry, he was within his year 30. It would be a rather strange way for us Westerners to reckon the years of a person's life. During the whole of a person's 30th year, the word meaning about or as if was used to denote that year. Luke records, quote, Jesus began, meaning his ministry, about 30 years of age, end quote. And this is in Luke 3:23. Irenaeus, however, shows what Luke meant. Irenaeus says, quote, For when he, meaning Jesus, was baptized, he had not yet completed his 30th year. And indeed, he was indeed 30 already, but he had not completed the 30th year, but was beginning to be about 30 years of age. This is Irenaeus Against Heresies, Book 2, Chapter 22, Section 5. Irenaeus had just said that he was already 30, age 30 in paragraph 4, so beginning to be about 30 was used for a person all the way to from the beginning to the end of a person's year 30. During the whole of a person's year 30, the word meaning about or as if was applied. When his year 30 ended, he would have concluded his year 30. This means that Jesus was indeed 30 years old, according to our reckoning, when he began his ministry, but he had not yet completed his 30th year. Irenaeus said that this was the time that the Jews called a man a master. And this is Irenaeus also, same citation. It may appear strange to us that the word about is used to indicate something like our word being, but this is the way it was interpreted by Irenaeus, and he spoke Greek in the idiom that was near to that of the New Testament. Gregory Nazianzus also understood the idiom to signify the fact that Jesus was a full 30 years of age. He said, quote, Christ was 30 years old when he was baptized. And this is in his Orations on Baptism, book 29. A man had to be fully 30 years of age to be a master. The Apostle Paul has more evidence. In the book of Galatians, the Apostle Paul said the Gentile Galatians were suddenly going over to keeping the Mosaic law because people from Jerusalem taught them the need to do so. Indeed, the Galatians were, quote, observing days, months, times, and years, according to Galatians 4, verse 10. Note the italicized word years. Within the context of Paul's rebuke to the Gentile Galatians, this can only refer to their observing, the verb is in the present tense, to their observing the sabbatical years of the Mosaic Law, which was only required, by the way, for people that were in the land, not even for Jews outside of the land. This, again, is an important chronological clue. The sequence of sabbatical years in the period when the book of Galatians could have been written was 41 to 42 A.D., 48 to 49 A.D., 55 to 56 A.D. And since 55 to 56 A.D. is well after the Jerusalem Council of 49 A.D., this could not be the sabbatical year the Galatians were observing. It is manifestly too early for 41 to 42 A.D. to be considered. The only possibility is the sabbatical year of 48 to 49 A.D. If this were the sabbatical year Paul was referring to, they were actively observing, and note that Paul used the present tense, observing. One can understand the Apostle Paul's urgent concern for their behavior. In fact, it was not even necessary for Jews to observe sabbatical years outside the designated lands associated with Palestine. But here were Gentiles, the Galatians, and Gentiles at that, now observing the official sabbatical year of 48 to 49 in Asia Minor. And only that year fits. Once the proper sequence of sabbatical years is understood, we can now appraise some significant New Testament historical statements in a much better way. For one point, we now know that the autumn of 48 to 49 AD was a sabbatical year. This is a time when all agricultural activity in Palestine would have ceased. Such ritualistic requirements were often very traumatic for the Jewish people who lived in the Holy Land, and this was especially true in the six-month period that succeeded at any sabbatical year. In other words, after the sabbatical year ended, those next 6 months before the next harvest, pretty rough. The fact is, they had effectively been cut off from earning any money from land products during the sabbatical period. This point is a major one in interpreting several statements in various sections of the New Testament. Since Palestinian Jews were usually in dire economic straits during sabbatical years, and in the 6 months that followed, it was customary for Jews in the diaspora, in other words, those living outside of Palestine, to send money and foodstuffs to their brethren in the Holy Land. However, when Palestine was not undergoing drought or keeping sabbatical years, there is ample evidence to show that the region was very productive very productive in which to live. Even Titus, the later Roman emperor, said that Judea was proportionately more prosperous than Rome itself. And this Josephus cites Titus as saying this in both Wars of the Jews and in Antiquities. But when the Jews ceased agricultural pursuits in observing sabbatical years, many of them became poorer, as the scriptures attest. It may seem like a moot point, but when Paul and Barnabas were given the right hand of fellowship that they should go to the Gentiles, and the pillar apostles were assigned to the circumcision, an extra requirement was imposed on Paul that he, quote, remember the poor. And this is in Galatians 2, verse 10. The poor in question, as the context certainly shows, were the poor among the Jews in Palestine, because Paul and Barnabas would surely have considered it incumbent upon themselves to show benevolence upon the Gentiles to whom they were commissioned to preach. Why were the Jews poor? Well, the answer should be evident once the sequence of sabbatical years is recognized. The truth is, 48 to 49 AD was a sabbatical year, and the Apostle Paul had the conference with the pillar apostles sometime in AD 48, right at the start of the sabbatical year. There would have indeed been many poor in Palestine during the next year and following. It was always the year after a sabbatical that was the most severe in food shortages. And yet there is more. The Apostle Paul went to Corinth while on his second missionary journey, as it's called, arriving there near the autumn of 50 AD or early 51 AD. He spent 18 months in Corinth, according to Acts 18 and verse 1. There is archaeological information which shows that Gallio, the Roman proconsul, was in office between January 25th, 52 AD, and before August 1st, 52 AD. Those 8 months, roughly a little bit less than 8 months, 7 months actually. Paul went, and this is in Jack Finnegan's Handbook of Biblical Chronology. The Apostle Paul went before Gallio, the Roman proconsul, at that time. This is in Acts 18, verses 12 to 17. Afterward, in the middle part of 52 AD, Paul went to Jerusalem and finally back to his home base in Antioch of Syria. This according to Acts 18, verses 21 to 22. Then in the spring of 53 AD, Paul started out on his third missionary journey, according to Acts 18, verse 23. Reaching Ephesus in late spring of 53, he stayed there for 2 years. This is in Acts 19, verse 10. And near the end of that period, and just before the Passover season in 55 AD, he wrote his first epistle to the Corinthians. And this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. He ordered them, as he had those in Galatia, to save up money and goods to give to the poor saints in Jerusalem, according to 1 Corinthians 16, verse 15. Afterwards, he went to Macedonia, and from there he wrote 2 Corinthians in late 55 AD. He wrote the Corinthians at that time, in 2 Corinthians, two long chapters about the collection for the poor saints in Jerusalem, praising them that even from before, meaning the sabbatical years, which began with Tishri in 55 AD, the Corinthians had started to save their money and their produce. And this is related in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 10, and 9, verse 2. Then in late 55 AD, Paul went on to Corinth, where he wintered with them for 3 months, in Acts 20, verse 3. This is when he wrote his epistle to the Corinthians, telling them he was soon journeying to Jerusalem to deliver the collections he had secured from Galatia, Macedonia, and Greece. This was according to Romans 15, verses 25 to 33. The book of Romans was written in the early spring of 56 AD. He then left Corinth and went to Ephesus, now telling them it had been 3 years since he started preaching to them. And this is according to Acts 20, verse 31. He got to Jerusalem about the time of Pentecost in 56 A.D., this according to Acts 20, verse 16, approaching the end of the sabbatical year. Why are all these chronological data important to know? Because they show that Paul was taking produce and money to Jerusalem to help them through the sabbatical year from autumn 55 to autumn 56 AD. Not only does this information help us date the times when the epistles of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, as well as Romans, were written, but also the evidence helps confirm further the sequence of sabbatical years which Professor Watchholder has provided. When the complete ramifications of this chronological subject are recognized, it will be seen how important the proper interpretation of John 4, verses 35 to 38 really is. Jesus in that verse is talking about a sabbatical year. That indication represents a powerful chronological benchmark which can help us identify the years when the festivals took place that John mentioned in his gospel. When it is realized that the sabbatical year of 27 to 28 AD is the first year of Jesus' ministry, most of the other chronological indications in the Gospels and the Epistles can make much better sense. It especially denotes that 30 years before this sabbatical year, one arrives at 3 BC for the birth of Jesus. And this all makes sense when these things are understood. So thank you, Georgianne, for helping us wade through, allowing me to wade through all this.
Well, it's important information, David.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that these things help the listeners out there that are very serious about their studies.
Yeah.
You know, so we really appreciate you and the time that you give.
And they can open their Bibles and verify these things
Yes.
quite plainly and simply, and they don't have to agree, but they can, verify that, oh, yeah, now this makes sense. And it's like it opens it up finally,
Yes.
and sure enough, you know, this is reliable documentary material that the Scripture has in it. And, the Word of God doesn't need verification, but it's certainly nice to have when it's available.
Well, and there's a lot of people out there that want verification.
Sure.
Know, which I think is kind of funny. But anyway, David, God bless you for the time and the effort that you put in. And all the listeners out there, study. You know, read the church fathers. Read the books, the free books that are available at the AskElm.com website, and you will learn an awful lot of things. Fascinating material and extremely well thought out, footnoted. It's just an excellent website, and I do compliment you, David, and those that are behind the Ask Elm website. The way it's laid out, it's very functional, very easy to navigate, and there is a lot of free material up there. So everybody go have a look, and you can contact David Seeloff at this address, David at askelm.com. And that wraps it up for this particular series, The Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And David and I will be back, God willing, with something else that will be very interesting, we promise. This is George Ann Hughes with David Seeloff signing off tonight. God bless everyone out there. Good night.